feel weird. I feel like I'm supposed to be more enthusiastic, but I normally am.
Let Michael do that bit. Right. Hello and welcome to a special winter edition of the NRF1 podcast. I'm your, well, now one-time host, Callum Springall, supposedly budding F1 correspondent, although it's not quite got the same ring to it as Michael's intro. But anyway, after a long few months, we've arisen from our winter hibernation, although, to be fair, this is probably going to go out around the Monaco Grand Prix. No, Michael.
Poor Michael, he's a busy man.
And I'm here, as you can probably tell, with my brother, supposedly budding F1 engineer. And today's pod will presumably have a word or two on some engineering gibberish. Always fun. Not to mention a slight recap on some winter news and, who knows, maybe some predictions as well for the new year. You're probably not going to be here for much of it, so...
No.
I have to admit, this has been somewhat in the pipeline for about a year. So pretty much for the whole time that I've been with the NRF1. But originally, the gist of it was that we'd basically talk about your engineering. So... perhaps naturally you may have some advice and for some people in your kind of position, or perhaps sort of earlier on the road as you were.
Mm.
But I thought, at least to start off with, we'd probably talk about what you do with Jacopo and working on the race team. So I suppose just to start off, what's it like?
Days long. I mean, some very long days, especially when there's some crashes involved.
Ooh,
yeah,
a bit expensive.
Yeah, or one time a gearbox shit itself.
Very technical term.
Yes. So Snetterton last year we were somewhat busy and we had to send someone off to go all the way back to the other side of the country, almost into Wales again. The team is from Wales, in case people didn't know. So we sent him off and he came back at about 9 o'clock at night and had to replace bits of the gearbox input shafts and
this wasn't Dave the Truckee, was it?
Oh, not Dave the Truckee. No, this is Harry, the team boss's dad. Yeah. Sent him off. Dave the Truckee's a character. So the days are quite long, but it's all good fun and he makes some good friends. Plenty to do.
Yeah, I should think so. So how did you get there? Like, what was the start of it all? If we could go back to day one.
And what, from when I first started doing any sort of F3 stuff?
Yeah, I suppose.
Okay, so when I first started doing it, I think I was looking for... and cast my mind back to 2015.
Way back when?
Yeah, way back when. This time about 3 years ago. I was looking for some work experience outside of university, because the university have a Formula Student Team, which is basically just a design competition. And I'd done a couple of tests with the team. It was alright, but I thought the whole ethos of the Formula Student Domain was very much design-based, and I'm not particularly competent at design because I find it rather boring, if I'm being honest, and you have to go through and test everything and make sure it's all load-cased. And so I was looking for some work experience on trackside and found a team in Morbarton for those in Norfolk, and so I kept pestering them, little family run team, and eventually got in with them, went down for a day during the Easter holidays, and they'd literally only just got Jacopo's car from Germany. They bought it from a team called Motorpark, based at the Oschersleben Arena, for those who are quite knowledgeable on the DTM. And, ended up taking tyres off rims and fitting a makeshift heat shield. We had a problem with the gear shift cable melting because it was so close to the exhaust. Yeah, that was kind of the first day, really, and then just took it from there. Ended up doing a bit more mechanic-based stuff. Spannering and just learning how all the car works and how you can change different things for the setup and how long it takes. Because part of the good thing of being a good engineer is knowing how long it will take for a setting to change. I had a story, probably going somewhat off track, but I had a story this year told to me when the team were doing British F3. They had an engineer who decided they were going to change the entire anti-roll bar just 5 minutes before qualifying, and this is about a 20-minute job. So, that's probably the base to know how long the setup takes to change, and that's kind of what I learned in the first few weeks, really.
But it didn't really last very long, or massively long, with that team. They ended up, I think, folding from the championship, and then you ended up leaving with Jacopo, didn't you?
Yeah, I actually spent 2 years with the team of Mobarton Omicron Motorsport, and that was good. We had some nice memories from there, going to Spa and
getting seasick on the way.
I wasn't actually sick, but yeah. Ferries. We had some good memories there. Spent a couple of years, but the first year was more sort of doing mechanics and turning cars around so they're ready for the next session. And it was basically just focusing on Jacopo, really. It was only one car for the majority of the time. Occasionally we ran a Hollywood stuntman in the team's original car. In the second year, I guess, it was a bit more sort of engineering-based, working on the data analysis and building models, mathematical models, to improve setup and stuff like that.
So how does it differ now that you're with CF Racing, in terms of what specifically you do?
So I do less of the mechanics now. I'm almost a pure engineer. So last year I was obviously working on the same car with Jacopo, because he just transferred over to CF Racing. So I had that base knowledge of the car and knew what where all the bits were, what spanners and different tools you needed for the bodywork, for example. And not much really changed. I kind of ended up doing less of the mechanics pre and post race weekend. But during the race weekend, I did a little bit, sort of getting the car ready, not necessarily all of the refueling and everything, which I didn't really like because it was a bit of a pain, and occasionally you'd get fuel everywhere. Not very good health and safety. But it was more computer based, and I was working on the car with someone that's vastly more experienced than me, and so I let him do all the mechanics, and I was better at all of the computing and engineering and everything, so I ended up just being the data engineer, I suppose, or probably even more performance engineer, seeing as it's more simulator based work between races. So yeah, the role hasn't changed massively, but it's somewhat the same.
It's quite interesting that you mentioned the simulator, actually, because it's particularly something that I use literally just for fun, a set of Corsa, if anyone's wondering. But does it really help that much, or is it all just fun and games?
No, it's
just an excuse to play games late at night.
It's not all fun and games. I wish it was, but it definitely helps. Some of the tracks in particular aren't very close to reality, but some of them, particularly the laser scanned ones like Silverstone and Brands Hatch and Spa, for example, are all very close to reality. And if you combine the game itself with all of this fancy kit like the Oculus Rift virtual reality, you can even have some kit like my own, for example, with load cell brake pedals, so it's a force based rather than distance-based pedal set, and expensive wheel servos and new steering wheels like I just got. But even Jacopo went full board on it, spending countless amounts of money on buying all of the best kit and setting it up. And he's even got himself a Formula Renault 2-litre crashed tub, which when it came and it arrived was a bit tatty, to say the least. It definitely had a big shunt, seeing as the engine mounting studs had been pulled right out, and the front bulkhead was only a half there. So it had quite a big shunt, and I hope the driver didn't die. But so he's gone full board on it, but we've even gone through making our own F3 simulator and doing all the maths on it, which over this winter has been updated to match the 2011 Dallara F3. Still under work, but it's getting close. So, yeah, the simulator does actually really help. It's probably nowhere near as good as the Formula One team simulators, because they can program everything themselves and they've got all of the maths down exactly how they want it, and they can change the design. And for example, say they wanted to change some of the aero, they could upload what's called an aero map, which is basically just a lookup table of ride heights and wing angles, for example, to work out what all of the downforce is. So yeah, they can just upload this new update willy-nilly and try out all sorts, really, for the driver to try out. So I should imagine it's very close to reality, but nowhere near as good as the Formula One team, seeing as they spend in the regions of millions of pounds rather than thousands.
So when you make a setup change in the simulator, does it really, like, do you get the sense that it reflects how, like, the same change that would happen if you made it in real life? Like, would Jacopo come in and say, this change has done this, when you go on the simulator, you realise that change does the same thing?
Yes, to a degree. The simulator isn't quite as sensitive as the real car, because with the real thing, obviously the driver can feel all of the G-force, and he's got everything at his fingertips, really. But in the simulator, you can only really use the vision and the feel through your hands and feet rather than through your body. So there's only so much that a particular setup change can do. Like, the wing angles will make the biggest difference, we've found, relative to the real thing. But then things like anti-roll bars will have a fairly noticeable difference. So it varies between different parameters and how sensitive the driver is feeling on any particular day. But on the whole, I think the changes are somewhat reflected.
So I suppose on the whole, it's all well and good saying, oh, I've done this, I've done that, and I've done the other. But what have you actually learned from it all over the last 3 years?
That you need to expand your bladder so that you can go a whole day without needing a p***. Or to have a d*** before you go to the circuit.
I didn't really want to know that.
Well, we cut that bit out.
No, I'm sending this all to Michael.
What else have I learned? That you can actually survive on about 4 hours sleep a night. That gentlemen drivers can be very picky with their money. They don't just throw things at it willy-nilly. They're quite careful.
Unless it's an engine rebuild.
Yeah, but you kind of need an engine rebuild. I think if anything, from a more personal level rather than professional level, I think that you learn how to really integrate into a team of new people. I've done it twice now, and it takes you a few weekends to really get into it. And motorsport is full of a lot of very nice people that will make you feel very welcome very quickly. But at the same time, there are also ones that make you feel a bit like the outsider for a while, but eventually they come around. Like Dave the Chucky. Bless him, we like Dave. And lot of people in motorsport have a lot of stories. People in motorsport know basically everyone. It's like being in Norfolk, everyone knows everyone. You learn so much in university that some of it's not really applicable, but in this case, everything you learn is applicable. And some of the stuff I have learned at university, I've gone, well, actually, this, you can do it like this and it'll work, or you can do it like this and it'll be so much better. And then there are other things, like I've been sitting in lectures, for example, and I've gone, well, if I can apply this in this manner, then it makes the whole lecture more interesting. And I think motorsport, coming back to the question, really teaches you how to think outside of the box and how you can really apply things to get the best out of either yourself or the car or the driver or just anything, really. And it really gives you the opportunity to try things out in a heated environment, and that's the only way you're going to learn how to work under pressure. If anything, working under pressure gets the best results.
So do you have, for people in your kind of league, I suppose, do you have any kind of last advice for them?
Find a team, just keep pestering them, email them, call them, whatever it is, write them a letter or go and see them. Just pester them until they say yes, and keep going until they say yes. And don't be disheartened if someone says no, because the worst they can say is no, and that's not entirely bad. So there's always someone out there that will be willing to give you the chance, even if it's just a club race, they're spending their own money and time on it, and just work hard and try and make a lasting impression, really, because the only way people will remember your skill sets and who you are and what you're good at is by making a lasting impression. So if anything, I would say you have to really give it everything and just keep going, really. You can't, in the face of adversity, go, I don't like this. If you really want it, you'll keep going and you'll fight through whatever difficulties you come across. So, and motorsport is not an easy business to work in, from what I've found. So, yeah, just keep going and soldier on, really. You can't do anything more than just make a mark on someone's company or whatever it is. You just have to keep going.
Right, so just a little bit on the upcoming season. 2018, of course, big year for, well, everyone, really. Just to recap some of the news from the winter. Obviously, most recently, there's the announcement at Williams. Sergei Sorokin, in case you didn't know, is partnering Lance Stroll. Is it really all about the money?
Well, money's definitely got something to do with it. Renault wouldn't have had him if he didn't have any money. I mean, his results aren't terrible. I can think of maybe some other people from junior categories that could well and truly be in that seat. Yeah, his results haven't been terrible, but they've not been great. He's got some money, which helps him. I think he will actually do a decent job, because I've seen all over Twitter and just social media that people really don't like this decision, because they see him as a pure pay driver rather than someone who's got some sort of talent. And I don't actually agree with that, because to get to Formula 1 in the first place, you need some sort of talent. So I think he's going to do a decent job this year. I really can't see him being a massive flop. I can see why people would have wanted to see Kubica in there, but personally at this stage, I think that's the right call.
Well, Sorokin was supposedly the quicker one in testing. So, I mean, the only gripe that you can have really is that effectively they brought it down to two pay drivers and then Danny Kvyat. Yeah. I suppose Kvyat, his downturn in performance for the last, 2 years or so, sort of makes him an unviable option anyway if you're not going to take a gamble.
Yeah.
But whoever they were going to pick, I mean, Sorokin's not experienced, Kubica's got his injuries, Kvyat's got the whole baggage from Toro Rosso. So let's just say that they whittled it down to two pay drivers for Kvyat and Sorokin. Like, they must have known through Kubica that firstly he had money. So I think he had something like 8 million behind him from...
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. But also there was the obvious commercial benefits, like the amount of interest that would be generated around that seat just because it's Robert Kubica. Surely would have brought the extra money that Sorokin is bringing. So therefore, it must be down to pace.
That's actually a really good point, because I've never really thought of it that way, but...
Or at least they brought it down to the fastest of the pay drivers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm trying to think of people that aren't necessarily a pay driver that would be good enough.
Everybody's a pay driver to some extent, because they're either good enough that they generate the interest around themselves that sponsors want to be involved, or they have money bringing them in anyway. Like even someone like Vettel or Hamilton. Perez, everyone raves about as being...
Well, he's an obvious pay driver, because most of the sponsors on the car, well, before BWT came in, most of the sponsors on the car were because of him.
And it's only palatable because he's a good driver.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that he's backed by one of the richest men in the world.
I think from that experience, everyone kind of has to give it a go. But I think there are a lot of people who are very much of the opinion that they want this sort of dream return of someone who didn't quite fully fulfil his potential. I can see why people are miffed about it, but at the same time, you have to give him a chance, because he is there for a reason. He has got some pace, and at the end of the day, people just have to accept it, because that's the decision that Williams made, and they thought that he was the fastest, and that's just how it is.
And let's say that wasn't the decision they made. Let's say they brought in Wehrlein, who's probably the most meritocratic decision in a lot of people's eyes. He didn't do that well against Ericsson, and he's got a weight advantage against Ericsson.
He didn't exactly blow him out of the water, didn't he?
Particularly in the second half of the season.
Yeah.
Plus, then he'd have the added backing from Mercedes. They'd probably take a load of money off of their...
engine supply.
Yeah. nobody was going to bring in Kvyat, as we've said.
Well, Ferrari signed him up as their development driver.
Yeah. But then again, Kubica's, Williams's development drivers, there's not really any difference between the two. And Ericsson was also linked, and he's one of the pay drivers in a lot of people's minds. And then Duress still was probably the only one who's not bringing significant money. And he was only ever an outside bet from the start. I suppose also another big news from our perspective would be in at Sauber's Charles Leclerc.
The ever fan favourite from Formula 2.
But it's also the whole tie-in between Alfa Romeo and Sauber is something that, believe it or not, Toto Wolff called a threat to Mercedes. He's come out and said, you know, this is something that we're going to think about doing with other teams. So perhaps, I don't know, Williams, Force India, somebody like that.
Well, this seems to be the new sort of trend, I suppose, although Red Bull started it with Toro Rosso back in 2006, wasn't it? So it's nothing, well, actually, I guess it's nothing really new, is it? But having a I guess, proper full-on customer effort, which is...
Or a junior team, if you will.
Yeah, or a junior team, isn't necessarily a bad thing for the sport, especially if it's got Ferrari involved, as I can't really see them leaving the sport anytime soon, despite what Marchionne's been threatening.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because the Alfa Romeo deal only runs until 2020, which is either a massive bargaining chip.
The new engine regulations come in 2021, isn't it?
So, yeah, which is the only point where they could potentially leave.
Yeah, but I suppose Ferrari historically, as the Scuderia itself, won't. I can't see them leaving personally, but having other manufacturers do the same probably isn't a bad thing for the sport. It might help equalise some of the performance deficits and budget deficit by maybe even offering reduced rates on engine deals. I can see the Sauber deal being actually a very positive thing for Formula One, and particularly for Ferrari's junior drivers like Leclerc and perhaps even Giuliano Alesi if he has some good results this year in...
Big if in
GP3. Yeah, I think we'll have to see what happens, I suppose, in the next few years. But if Mercedes do the same thing with Williams or Force India, I think that can probably only be a good thing.
Is it, though? Because let's say, if I'm going to play devil's advocate and say Mercedes take a team, Ferrari take a team, and so do Renault and McLaren and Red Bull have Toro Rosso. On a 10-team grid, half of the grid is controlled by the other half. So that's not particularly conductive to racing if all of the big teams have a hand over all of the other small teams.
Although there is the other argument that it's helpful for the rise of junior talent, but if you're going to argue that the senior teams will have more control on the racetrack of the junior efforts, then I can't think of many examples, if any at all, where Red Bull have said to Toro Rosso, you need to move over. Like if you... Well, this is probably going back too far, but in 2008, Toro Rosso beat Red Bull in the Constructors' Championship, so... Yeah,
even in 2015, they were still racing them on track at times.
Yeah, exactly, so...
But then again, not everyone's quite as liberal as Red Bull.
Exactly,
particularly Ferrari.
I mean, it could go one of two ways, really, couldn't it? So, personally, I see more of the benefits or the positive side than the negative side, but that might just be because I'm more of an optimist.
There's been sort of quite a lot of discomfort around this season, really, partly because... The new logo apparently is not
quite as well received as they probably hoped, I should imagine.
Well, yeah. Plus, also, there's the whole kicking up of dust around the halo, which personally I think is a load of dross.
Yeah, and Formula 2 has now adopted that, which, as I read not so long ago, that Dallara had quite the challenge of retrospectively fitting the halo to the new chassis.
As well as Force India.
As well as Force India. But the FIA have also now, this might even be in some of your extra news, that they've announced that there will be a minimum weight limit for the drivers with some extra ballast, I think. It's like 80 kilos minimum weight. And then I think if the driver is like under 75 kilos or something naturally, then I don't know, it's all load of biology that I'm not familiar with, but it's something they've tried to introduce for the heavier drivers.
But if they're introducing ballast, depending on where they actually put it, could it still not be quite beneficial to the lighter drivers?
Yeah, To be honest, I can't really see anything changing from it, but I'd have to read up on exactly what the rule is. I think the current rule is saying that there will be ballast in the seat itself, so that will then neutralises because that's in the exact same place for everyone else. But then there are still going to be drivers that will try and get unhealthily lean so that they can run more of that ballast, and then they'll have a bit more room to play with the weight distribution. So, I don't know. I really can't see it working.
But just to go back to the halo quickly. Surely, because when the FIA were presenting it in, I think it was the Hungarian Grand Prix, they basically made the case for about half an hour that in every single scenario that they tested, in broad terms at least, the halo had either a neutral impact, so no impact at all, or a positive one. Mm. So while it would have, it probably wouldn't have saved any of like Ayrton Senna, Jules Bianchi or Justin Wilson, surely it's totally necessary. Plus it's something that if they implement now, they can develop in future years, and people like IndyCar are running different solutions entirely. So throughout the whole motorsport world, there is something to learn. Like LMP have the canopies, if that's something that they want to go down. F1, F2 now have the halo. And IndyCar, I think, from next year or beyond that, are going to have the shield.
Well, I think the shield needs a bit more development, because I think after Vettel tried it in Silverstone, that was the final nail in the coffin for that, really, because the FIA just said, no, we're not going to have this. The halo seems to be the current best option, but I think IndyCar may well provide some added insight into development of the shield. And I think going with the sports car example, the canopies are more widely accepted in sports car, as it's now a current safety rule that all cars must be a coupe rather than a open cockpit as such. But I definitely think that these safety devices are needed. Maybe they won't save lives in, say, for example, the Ayrton Senna case or the Jules Bianchi case, but if you take the Henry Surtees crash, that almost would have certainly saved his life. Then there's even the example of Massa's crash in Hungary in 2009. Would that have prevented it entirely? Would it have deflected the spring towards his chest? Would it have deflected the spring across the car? There are so many eventualities and
ramifications.
And ramifications across the entire world, and so many different things can happen that no one can predict the future unless you want to try and develop some sort of future transportation machine or some sort of looking glass. No one can predict the future, and you have to take as many precautions as you can in potentially the world's most dangerous sport historically to prevent people from dying doing what they love. And a long time ago, that was widely accepted as being part of the risk, but now in the modern world, it's all about preservation of life, and I personally think the halo is needed. Is it the right solution? Probably not at this moment in time, but people are going to always kick up a fuss about change, and that's just the way the world is, and you just have to move with it and be progressive. And maybe that's just because I'm a young person that's also a student. So, yeah, that's just the way the world is. People have to accept it and move on.
I suppose at the end of the day, the decision they've taken is the one that they honestly believe is the best. Mm. They brought it in just about in time for pretty much every team to adapt. Mm. They didn't toy with the shield after July until sort of November, and then say, oh, well, actually, we're going to go for the halo. They've made the decision. They've made a calculated decision. We have to live with it. And, well, as we know, technology never stays the same. It's always developing. So there's every chance that it might actually become not aesthetically pleasing, but more palatable as time goes on.
Mm. Well, if you take the example of when the rules changed in 2009, everyone said, well, we don't like this. They look horrible. Or even as recent as 2014, when we had all the thumb noses and what we've got now. Originally, people were like, well, we don't like this. Can we go back to what we had? And they'd kick up a big fuss. And at the end of the day, people have just accepted it, because I don't hear anything complaining about the look of the front wing or the nose anymore.
Mm. Well, they are more palatable. I mean, it's not like Torosso's and Summer's nose.
Yeah. So I think people just move on. They forget, and they find something else to moan about. So give it a year, probably even a few months after the start of the season, and no one will make notes the difference. Everyone will probably forget about it, like with the knockout qualifying.
I had forgotten about that. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me.
Hello everyone, this is Jake Humphrey here. You're listening to the best Formula One podcast from the best county in the world, the NRF1 podcast. And I wasn't paid any money to say that.
No, I did give you some beers.
So now that we've got the new season coming up, thought we'd make some, possibly some predictions, but at least speculate along the way.
Mm.
And I suppose in principle, we're going to talk about designing, or the designs of the cars, and what they're expected to be.
Mm-hmm.
So to start off with Mercedes, they've had, obviously for the last year, a lot, well, the diva as they put it, one with quite low rake, quite a lot of peak downforce, and when you compare that with Ferrari, it's a lot more, the Ferraris is a lot more high rake, it's a lot more manageable downforce for the driver, for the engineers as well, which is supposedly the route that Mercedes are now going to take. If we take the idea that improvement largely comes from stability, like when you see a stability in the rules over the course of a few years, there's a lot more development, at least in the short term.
Mm.
Like if you take, for example, 2010, they came up with everything like the blown exhaust, far more cascades on the front wing. By 2011, Red Bull were as quick then as Ferrari were in 2008. And this is even with heavier cars. So surely for Mercedes, the best thing to do would just be, to some extent, to keep what they have, but go a little bit more towards what Ferrari have, rather than completely abandon their whole philosophy. So they could, I mean, it's totally possible that they end up on the right road and end up being the main beneficiaries of it.
Hmm.
But then again, it's also entirely possible that they go completely the wrong way and they're losing out to Ferrari and Red Bull.
And the thing is, the development of this year's car would have already started 12 months ago easily. So the team have had plenty enough time to have tried out different things in the simulator, and perhaps they would have made some initial designs that perhaps run with, for example, the high rate concept. And I think they would have had plenty of time to look into it and develop it to the point where it was better, if not more drivable, and through CFD the team will know whether they have the same amount of downforce for a given condition. They'll know what the operating window is of the car's floor. So yeah, you can argue that they could go down the wrong track at the end of the day, but they're clever people and they know what they're doing. They've won 4 world championships on the bounce for a reason. And you could say that's possibly down to their stability of concept, but at the end of the day, I personally think that they will have the manpower to pull off a new concept and make it usable and very quick straight out of the garage. So if anything, I think it's going to be more down to the race team rather than the design team to get this car working. But if it's a concept which in theory has more usable downforce or is better mechanically, then I actually think that a change of concept won't harm them, because if it's more usable, then it's more usable and the driver has a better window to use the tyres in, which I suppose may actually well work in Bottas's favour to close his gap to Hamilton. So yeah, I think the change in concept can't be an entirely bad thing for them.
And then I suppose in contrast, Ferrari are allegedly looking more towards a longer wheelbase. Apparently it's 6 centimetres according to Sky F1. Does that really make that much of a difference?
3 centimetres makes a fair amount of difference.
What, 6?
Well, it's 6, was it? So yeah, 6 centimetres is into the realm of playing around with your centre of gravity position and how all of the tyre forces work to control the understeer and oversteer balance when you're on the throttle. And so the longer wheelbase will probably tend to make the car more stable under acceleration, so it may well work in their favour at Monza, for example, which is quite ironic. But it will work to their detriment in places where you need a good turning radius, like at Monaco. So I think it may well make the car a bit more drivable. It might help save the rear tyres a bit more. It will probably end up making the car understeer a touch more, but there are stuff that you can change with the front suspension which will help with that. To be honest, it'll make a significant difference, but they'll have the knowledge and the reasoning behind it that they will know what to change to sort of negate any of the negatives of changing it, or perhaps they'll even have specific wheelbases for specific circuits. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the day they decide that at Monaco they want to have the short wheelbase, so that they'll have to make a specific bell housing, which is the component in the car which is between the engine and the gearbox, and it holds the clutch. They'll probably have to end up making that shorter and have the new floor a bit shorter, which will probably impact on the aerodynamics. But yeah, a longer wheelbase may well work in their favour. It may well have no difference at all. It could go either way.
So what you're saying is that basically it's down to the race team again?
To a certain degree.
Then again, it's also entirely possible that they're going to go down the wrong route, and ironically, perhaps one of the main beneficiaries of that eventuality would be Red Bull, because they've had a supposedly early start to this year.
Mm.
And there's every chance, at least with two of the best drivers on the grid, or what are thought to be the two best drivers on the grid, there's every chance that they could challenge for the title this year.
Yeah, there is every chance. I mean, if they can catch up with Ferrari, then they're not a million miles off Mercedes, and who knows how this year's title fight could go. It could well be a three-way or even six-way fight, depending on whether the two drivers from each team are on it. So I think if Red Bull get in on the act and they've developed their car well enough, and it's more of an evolution rather than a revolution, then they may well be up there fighting for wins and hopefully even the championship. So this year could be very interesting.
I mean, I have to say, I kind of feel like I'm Arsene Wenger at the minute, saying before every season, oh, this team can win it, and this team can win it, and this team can win it, and so can these three others.
Mm.
And there's also McLaren as well. I mean, they're now more or less on a level footing with Red Bull. They've gone through the last 3 years of saying, oh, well, our chassis is very good, but Honda is sh-.
See, this is where McLaren's word from the last few years is going to be well and truly tested, because if they're not on the pace, they are going to be the laughing stock of the grid, if they weren't already. And people are really... That's going to have a big dent on the company, as well as the race team, if they go, well, look, our car is probably even better than the current world championship winning car, it's just the engine. I think it's a case of just have to wait and see, but without an engine that will get you up to the speeds in order to work the tyres, you'll never work the tyres in the first place, and it's all a snowball effect, so who knows what will happen. I have no idea. I would like to see them on the pace, and I would like to see if their car is better than Mercedes with a half-decent engine in it, but it's only a small upgrade, seeing as Renault is the third best engine on the grid rather than the fourth.
But surely in terms of pace, it's quite a big upgrade, because the difference between Honda and Renault particularly last year, was huge, but between Renault and Ferrari, it's not anywhere near as big.
Mm. Yeah, you can argue that it's a significant upgrade in terms of pace, but I think McLaren is going to be a case of suck it and see, really. I can't think of any reason why making a prediction on it would be a sensible idea. But from some of the predictions I made last year, sensible isn't exactly the word I would go for.
At least you didn't say anyone would end up on Mars.
Well, no, that's true. But I did say there'd be a Mexican wrestler on the grid, on the podium in Mexico, but it ended up being a DJ.
I suppose if we're talking about Renault, then we might as well discount them right from the off. I'm pretty sure at some point Squirrel Irritable
has recently grilled the grid on. If anyone's not seen it, go on the Formula One website and try and find the Grill the Grid episode with Cyril Abiteboul, and then there's one with Christian Horner as well, and you'll understand what we're talking about.
I'm pretty sure that he said in the past that they're not looking to challenge for the championship until around 2019 or 2020.
Well, I guess that kind of just shows how bad a position that the Lotus team was in when they bought the thing. But I think even with Hülkenberg and Sainz, they might well be fighting for fifth and sixth in the constructors again. I can't really see them going forwards, but it depends how much they improve relative to everyone else, really.
But also with the stability of the rules comes a lot more parity, in theory, between the teams. Mm. So possibly, hopefully, teams like Renault, Force India, potentially Williams, if they really get their act together, can go for podiums and maybe the odd win if they're lucky.
To be honest, this year, if McLaren get their act together and Red Bull are up there fighting for wins, then this is probably going to make the midfield battle even more exciting than it was this year,
because then if the midfield teams also take a step forwards and McLaren join the hunt properly, it's then going to be McLaren, Renault, Force India, Williams, Toro. It'll be a five-way fight for, say, fourth in the Constructors' Championship.
Right, well, I think we've been talking for nearly an hour.
And we might have to cut it there.
Well,
unless you've got any other business.
Well, not particularly.
No.
Apart from, I suppose, the smaller teams, like Force India have struggled with the Halo, but they tend to get their act together anyway, so could still be up there with, obviously, the Mercedes engine. Two pretty competent drivers, as long as they're not giving each other handbags.
Yeah, try not to kill each other. And
Williams is possibly not so promising with their potentially average drivers, despite the fact that they've supposedly started quite early as well. Who else is there? Oh, Toro Rosso with the Hondas.
I think that's going to be a sight for sore eyes. They're going to be the new McLaren.
Just makes Pierre Gasly think he's joined at the wrong time.
Yeah.
I think we might leave it there then. So, got to think about how to wrap it up.
No, this is probably even harder than it is to open.
Well, we've had a lot of engineering gubbins and gibberish, so we've kind of lived up to our expectation. Obviously, the NRF1 will be back. Don't know in quite what capacity. Maybe the same as last year, but we'll see. Presumably we'll be back for testing. I'm not quite in the know with regards to that. But anyway, I hope everyone's had a good winter. I hope everyone's enjoyed it. Thank you for listening, and it's goodbye from my brother.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from me. Goodbye.